Generous support to CPOW 95.9 is provided by Into the Music, quality collectible music since 1987. Into the Music is located in the Exchange District, 245 McDermott at the corner of King Street. To receive our twice-weekly newsletter, call the store or go online at intothemusic.ca to sign up. And kick off your Friday evenings at 7:30 with us at our in-store stage for free all-ages shows featuring local bands and performers.
In Montreal 2 weeks ago that got major international headlines as violent and anti-Semitic and that were denounced by the Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau. Finally, we hear about the non-violent act of civil disobedience waged at Parliament Hill demanding an arms embargo against Israel for crimes that continue to be used against the latest historic genocide. On this week's program, Canadian and Jewish voices say no to financing and supporting crimes fought in their name. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 6th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Ojibwe, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The settlers to this land attained an abundance of resources, but took much of it through false promises, broken treaties, force, and the doctrine of discovery at the expense of the indigenous peoples who were here first, and the current generation should acknowledge the crimes of their privilege and seek to rectify the damage done to these people as a result, so we can move forward in a spirit of a mutually reinforcing partnership of respect in the years ahead. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. Bloomberg noted that officials said last month that the U.S. Defense Department had the authority to remove about $6.8 billion from Pentagon inventories, but acknowledged growing doubts and risks to the U.S. military's capabilities as the Biden administration enters its final stretch. The White House called on Congress to provide an additional $24 billion in security assistance for Ukraine at the end of November, as U.S. arms stocks are dwindling, the outlet reported. Despite the uncertainty surrounding Donald Trump's return to the presidency due to a possible withdrawal of military aid to Kiev, the Biden administration is reportedly seeking to allocate these requested funds as, quote, emergency spending, unquote. Bloomberg reported that the White House had requested $8 billion for the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, which funds long-term arms contracts with U.S. defense contractors. Biden is not the only world leader scrambling to throw away more wasted resources at Ukraine before Trump enters the White House next month. That comes from the article, U.S. military aid to Ukraine exceeds a massive $62 billion under the Joe Biden administration, quote, throwing money away, unquote, to the detriment of the American people. By Ahmed Adel, posted December 4th, originally published on InfoBricks. Susan describes what she witnessed during her 2 week visits in Gaza earlier this year. Carpet bombing of schools, hospitals, children and women, of blown off children's heads, legs, arms, feet, of famine-driven children and their mothers, women, lured to explosive-laden food cans, poisoned water. She describes how Palestinian death is the driving force behind this diabolical torture and death machine called Zionist Israel. Yet, Susan Abulhawa,
ends her remarks to the Oxford Union debate on an unexpected positive note, looking forward into a restored and rehabilitated Palestine. Quote, "Someday your impunity and arrogance will end. Palestine will be free. She will be restored to her multi-religious, multi-ethnic, pluralistic glory. We will restore and expand the trains that run from Cairo to Gaza to Jerusalem, Haifa, Tripoli, Beirut, Damascus, Amman, Kuwait, Sana'a, and so on. We will put an end to the Zionist American war machine of domination, expansion, extraction, pollution, and looting. And you will either leave or you will finally learn to live with others as equals," unquote. That comes from the article, quote, "Palestine, My Palestine," unquote, by Susan Abulhawa and Peter Koenig, posted December 4th. Before the U.S. entered WW2, a series of studies by the Council on Foreign Relations, subsequently adopted by the Roosevelt administration, declared it to be the policy of the U.S. government to attain total military dominance of the entire world. In 1991, the Wolfowitz Doctrine introduced a new refinement that the U.S. would carry out preemptive war against any nation or combination of nations that conceivably could threaten that dominance. In 2001, around the time of quote-unquote 9/11, the U.S. declared a further refinement, that of, quote, full-spectrum dominance, unquote, to assure that no other nation or combination of nations could threaten U.S. supremacy in any sphere of warfare, land, sea, air, space, or cyberspace. Until the U.S. officially rescinds these serial declarations, they obviously remain in force and determine every other action. Nothing can be allowed by any branch of government to undermine or negate them. That comes from the article, "The Stated Objective, Total Military Dominance of the Entire Planet, Full Spectrum Dominance," by Richard C. Cook, posted December 4th, originally published on Three Stages. Netanyahu justified the truce to his own people by saying that it will allow Israeli forces to focus on Gaza and Iran, and only diehard, quote-unquote, security minister Ben-Gvir voted against the truce in the Israeli cabinet. While there were hopes that the truce in Lebanon might set the stage for a ceasefire in Gaza, Israel's actions on the ground tell a different story. Satellite images show Israel carrying out new mass demolitions of hundreds of buildings in northern Gaza to build a new road or boundary between Gaza City and North Gaza. This may be a new border to separate the northernmost 17% of Gaza from the rest of the Gaza Strip, so that Israel can expel its people and prevent them from returning, hand North Gaza over to Israeli settlers, and squeeze the desperate, starving survivors in Gaza into an even smaller area than before. And for all who had hopes that the ceasefire in Lebanon might lead to a regional de-escalation, those hopes were dashed in Syria when, on the very day of the truce, the rebel group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, launched a surprise offensive. That comes from the article, "Truce in Lebanon, Can Diplomacy Rise from the Ruins?" by Medea Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davies, posted December 4th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Dr. Miles Howe is an assistant professor of critical criminology in the Department of Sociology at Brock University. He co-authored a recent report on Canadian charitable support for crimes against the Palestinian people. The report exposes millions in tax-deductible donations supporting illegal Israeli settlements
and military activities. It calls for immediate suspension of charitable status. Welcome to the show, Professor Howe.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You got five charitable organizations that seem to be supporting Israeli war crimes and dispossession of Palestinians, masked as charity. In fact, your study is called Under the Guise of Charity, Canadian Funding for War Crimes in Occupied mm-hmm. Palestine. How exactly did you receive the information for your database? Because I assume it's not tax information is not generally accessible to the public.
Well, I guess starting a few years ago, myself and a co-researcher got familiar with framing requests under the Access to Information Act to the CRA themselves. The information is actually available spanning a six-year period from the last fiscal year on the CRA's open access database. You just have to become a little bit familiar about what kind of data sets you want to get at. Certain data sets are not available, but are available unredacted via access to information request. And because of the nature of this data, this is data that the charities themselves have filed. And so there's no redaction capabilities on the part of the CRA in this situation. It's all a matter of framing your requests and then getting your hands on, you know, multiple decades of data sets. And so that's what that looks like. And so we're able to, through, you know, figuring out the wording, access the names and dollar amounts, or at least what should be there of the proper reporting of these Canadian charities when it comes to their intermediaries, as well as data pertaining to who does the giving. Privacy law, you know, dictates that we can't know the names of individual donors to a charity, but we can trace the flow of money going from one charity to another. And specifically, when you're talking about charitable organizations being those frontline operators, the ones moving the money into another country or doing international business, you can find who's given money to them if it's coming from a registered charity. And then frequently you can find who is associated with this charity, what type of fortune, et cetera, from the private sphere.
What exactly happens to the money once it leaves the donor's hands and goes into the Israeli war projects against Palestinians?
Well, this is, you know, not to make the situation more complex, but there's a lot of indications here that the regulator itself, the CRA, is either complicit in this situation or simply incapable of tracking the activities of the charitable organizations that it's mandated to do. I say this because it's generally in our, you know, brief but in-depth research into these charities, it's generally a two-step process, and that the first step that you find is that these charities are simply not filling out their Schedule II overseas activities forms to completion. As I was saying, you're supposed to note by name and dollar amount when you're using international intermediaries who they are and how much they've received. Mizrahi organization, which made the list in the report, for example, between 2007 and 2021, moved over $46 million into Israel, and yet named properly filled out the forms for about $600,000 of that. So you're dealing with about $45 million and change in money in charitable tax deductible donations, state subsidized, that have moved through Mizrahi organization into Israel with no known recipient. It's only as a result of probably related to complaints and energies being expended on the part of different action groups such as Just Peace Advocates towards, you know, demanding at least this bare modicum of reporting that we begin to know in 2022 and in 2023 who those recipients are. Specifically, if we're looking at Mizrahi organization, dozens of these are located in the illegal settlements. Others within the Israeli charitable sector focus primarily and exclusively on Palestinian dispossessions, such as Regavim, Elad Ur David, Women in Green, Im Tirtzu, And others are actually financing, Israeli military units and outfits such as Dovdovan Foundation and Oren and other organizations that are in receipt of Canadian tax donations. And so all of this is illegal under a variety of customary international law, criminal code, and Income Tax Act infractions.
Do you have any estimate as to how long operations like this, this charitable financing, maybe even a money laundering system, has been operating in Canada?
Well, it's a good question. Another one of the charities that we highlight in the report, Jewish Heritage Foundation of Canada, myself and a co-author back in 2022, were able to track the flows of money emanating from private and public foundations specifically in the methodology I was early just sort of briefly explaining. And it appears to be the third incantation of what we termed a burner charity. And so dating back into the earlier 2000s, you have a phenomenon where these charities are registered for years, do little to no financial activity. I would imagine under the CRA's risk profiling matrix, gain some measure of credibility. And then within a matter of months or within 1 year of fiscal reporting, we see a ballooning of their money moving into Israel, directly coming from some of the ultra rich foundations attached to real estate empires, financial investment in Canada, largely located within the GTA in Montreal. And so whenever the CRA then comes down on them, specifically this one called Gates of Mercy. This scam for them started in about 2006, when the CRA forces them into a compliance agreement in 2012. The donations largely evaporate and shift en masse into another charitable organization, in this case known as Beit Olath Charitable Organization. Mm-hmm. When the CRA finally catches up, begins to audit and work towards the revocation of the status of the Beit Olath Charitable Organization, all that money has moved en masse into the Jewish Heritage Foundation of Canada. Mm-hmm. And so is there a wider money laundering scam afoot? It's very much open to conjecture at this point. What we do know is that you can trace some heavy users of these charities that have since had their status revoked, and they currently move tens of millions of dollars across a variety of international intermediaries, some more suspect than the others, into Israel and the United States. Within highlighting Jewish Heritage Foundation of Canada in the current report, some of those intermediaries in Israel do involve settlement and settlement supportive Israeli charitable organizations.
We already have restrictions on donations to places like Cuba, Venezuela, Iran, and to Gaza even. Because the aid has to go through governments that Canada does not trust. Canadian charities going to Israel is getting through. That seems to suggest, like you had suggested, the possibility that the Canada Revenue Agency is, somehow in on it in some capacity or other. Is the recent incident with those top two, Neiman and GANF, was that... as a result of the International Court of Justice measures genocide supported by Israel, what would have gotten them to change their mind, I guess you would say.
I mean, we're playing a conjectural game here, right? Yeah. Within the audit itself, there's no clear statement of the ICJ ruling. And there's also no clear statement within the report of any legal parameters to which Canada is beholden to beyond the Income Tax Act itself, right? And so they're not particularly highlighting within those two audits that you mentioned, Neiman and JNF Canada. There's nothing in the reports mentioning the illegality of Israeli settlement recipients. There's a statement related to the non-charitable purpose activities of certain intermediaries. Those include Elad David, Women in Green, and a few that are related to supporting Israeli military ventures in the case of Ne'eman Canada. And as I was saying, specifically, Keren Kayemet Israel when it comes to JNF Canada. But there's nothing in there saying, even to the degree of, you know, referencing global affairs, public policy on the matter, that the Fourth Geneva Conventions apply to Israel's occupation of the Israeli territories, which makes it customary and internationally illegal to move settlements of civilian populations into occupied territories. It makes no mention of, for example, the internalization and the integration of the Rome Statutes or the Geneva Conventions Act themselves into Canadian law under the Geneva Conventions Act and the Crimes Against Humanity and War Crimes Act, which make such activities and financial complicity in the aiding and abetting of such activities indictable offenses under the criminal code. And so the CRA in those two revocations that it has made public has been very careful to keep it within the confines of the Income Tax Act itself, right? It's not making any statements as to Canada's position vis-a-vis the settlements or the genocide or anything of that nature. It's certainly not referencing the ICJ ruling, right?
Yeah.
And so a game of like, it becomes a game, and I'm not suggesting here that the situation is at all funny or enjoyable to anyone, but it becomes a conjectural exercise to to determine why now, right?
I know the press in Canada, I mean, they're concerned right now about foreign interference. And so you'd think this should be a major news story. Were there any major press organizations in Canada that caught interest in your report since the November 8th press conference?
No. City News showed up at the press conference and, you know, to their credit, aired a six-minute interview with the UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine and the Occupied Territories, Francesca Albanese. There's been zero interest in any of this. You know, we get a bone thrown at us from time to time from and I'm not trying to, you know, make light of them, but, you know, a cub reporter at the CBC, for example, will, you know, every now and then say, like, very interested in, for example, this report or other attempts to move this into the mainstream discourse that we have attempted in the past. And then they're quickly shut down and you never hear from them again. Whether that's, you know, an editorial sort of icing of this issue as a whole, I have no idea. But the statements that we're making, again, as I've said since for, you know, at least a couple of years now, this is all, this can all be verified via primary source material, right? This is not a statement that I'm making of some grandiose nature. this is not even a question of morality or where you stand on a certain issue. This is, again, a question of, do we have a rules-based order within this context, the Income Tax Act, and arguably, you know, aspects of the criminal code and our position as a state within the United Nations? Do we have a rules-based order that applies equally to everybody? Or do certain lives get to benefit from exclusion from rules-based order, and do certain lives suffer from that? And unfortunately, we find ourselves in the latter situation. These, again, What we're talking about is blatant abuse of the charitable sector, proven by data that the charities themselves have chosen to disclose to the CRA. And to me, this should be a no-brainer. Why we're continually just sort of outside the gates of power, you know, continuing to do these types of actions with little or no understanding of whether they'll have any utility whatsoever. Is you know, more a sad you know, snapshot of the society in which we live in 2024.
Do you intend to follow up this report with either another report or with an action of some sort?
The problem is, in my mind, and I've been mulling it over and contemplating it, you know, beyond and I'd certainly be interested to for any commentary or considerations from anyone on this, is that when you're talking about a situation in which your targets become charitable organizations, right? These things are largely ethereal in nature. If you could tell me where, you know what I mean? Like, the Mizrahi Organization of Canada, or the Jewish Heritage Foundation of Canada, or the Ronan Harary Foundation. Ronan Harary perhaps is a bit different because he's the CEO and founder of Spin Master Toys and Paw Patrol. So there's a potential there for, you know, a BDS action. But for these charitable organizations, Ne'eman Canada, do you know anything about it? Because you know what I mean? Like, when you look at what, where are they located? Do they even have a website? Is there anything that public pressure can do, you know, that civil society can do? Because you've got two self-selecting, you know, at one end of the spectrum and another. You've got, you know, people who are choosing, yes, I am a Zionist. No, I do not believe in Palestinian human rights. No, I do not believe in territorial sovereignty of Palestine. Yes, I will financially support that. Yes, I will give my money to that. And on the other end, you have the Israeli recipients, right? Yes, we are fascists. Yes, we are messianic colonialists. No, we do not, you know, et cetera. And so there's nothing to do there in terms of trying to have, you know, a sit down conversation and attempting to, like, could you please just, you know, have, you know, a respect universally for human rights, et cetera. And so you're stuck with targeting the intermediary or the, you know, the bagman, as it were, to put it colloquially. And they're either, you know, you get sort of locked up into a game of whack-a-mole where you try to, like, target one and it simply reframes itself and moves on to another conduit. Or what you're trying to do now is sort of ask for legislative reform, right? Which is sort of the crux of the report in and of itself, asking for a charity status, you know, immediate suspension, pending investigation, you know, asking the RCMP to intervene with their war crimes unit to investigate these things, et cetera, right? So now you're making an appeal to a legal and regulator, you know, that may or may not have any interest, that may or may not be understaffed, or that, you know, at the end of the day, might be complicit in all of this, you know? And so asking for this type of reform presupposes that there's something, you know, some correct, if it weren't for these bad apples, you know, you could return to a correct system. You know, big philanthropy that rewards the ultra rich for, you know, their dalliances and throwing us the crumbs off the table. And so it's highly problematic as to what to even do with this, right? You can observe it being done. You can draw attention to it. Mainstream media seems completely uninterested for whatever reasons. And aside from Ne'eman and JNF Canada, which are, you know, certainly promising, there's been complete non-responsiveness to any of this on the part of the CRA. So where are we? I don't know. Do you know what I mean? I can continue to highlight these instances of transgression, et cetera, if people think it's useful. But what do we do beyond have a discussion about it where we, like, you know, highlight what is illegal and what's transpiring and, you know, attempt to shame the Canadian state and the regulator or whatever? I don't know what to do with all this.
We'll do what we can to raise awareness among the our various listeners. So thanks a lot for sharing more information with our listeners.
You're quite welcome.
You've been speaking to Miles Howe, assistant professor of criminology at Brock University and co-author of Under the Guise of Charity, Canadian Funding for War Crimes in Occupied Palestine.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
Two shows ago, we announced an anti-NATO demonstration while NATO held its 70th parliamentary session there. On the Friday, the protests got negative attention in the press. Windows were smashed and cars lit on fire, and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau denounced it as anti-Semitic and violent. We thought we would catch up with a special presenter at the weekend of activities criticizing NATO. Eve Engler is an author of several books on Canadian foreign policy and an activist. I got him to describe Friday's protest from his perspective.
Well, there were definitely were windows that were broken, and there was some cars that were one car that was lit on fire. The second one is a little bit more unclear to me. But I guess maybe the background here is that there was a NATO assembly, 70th parliamentary assembly taking place in Montreal. And it so happened that this NATO assembly coincided with this historic student strike for Palestine. So more than 40 associations, student associations representing about 85,000 students across Quebec, voted for a two-day strike, calling on their institutions to sever all ties with Israel. And the Convergence des Luttes Anticapitalistes, which is a long-standing organization, the convergence of anti-capitalist struggles, and a group called Désinvestir pour la Palestine, so Disinvest for Palestine, organized, which is a new group, not really known, they organized this Friday night demonstration beginning at 5:30 against the NATO summit. And that was the second day of the student strike. There was the day before on the Thursday at Concordia. It was a very big demonstration, at least 1,000 people inside and outside as part of the student strike. And then on the Friday, there was a whole series of anti-NATO demos. The Échec à la Guerre organized one in the afternoon in front of the convention center. There was another one I went to the Échec à la Guerre. I didn't go to the other one. There was a day of workshops at Université de Québec à Montréal around NATO, around Palestine and the links, and sort of taking the kind of anti-genocide movement and also bringing it into an anti-war, anti-NATO kind of perspective. And so a demo that left at 4:30 from the Émile Gamelin, which is basically the University of Quebec à Montréal, over to where the CLAC demo, the Convergence de Lutte Anticapitaliste demo, left at 4:30. It arrived there. I wasn't part of it. I arrived just before 6 o'clock, and there was at least 1,000 people, probably something like 1,500 people, rallying at Place des Arts, which is about 5 or 6 blocks away from the convention center where the NATO summit was about to begin. And we marched over, and I knew beforehand how the CLAC was framing the demonstration was block NATO, and they had posters all around my neighborhood, and in a boot, bloquons l'OTAN in French, boot coming down on NATO. So CLAC is known for organizing demonstrations that often have a black bloc contingent and stuff like that. And so it wasn't at all surprising to me that there would be the likelihood or possibility of some windows being broken. That has happened at many demonstrations before that CLAC has organized. And the cops came out very aggressive, and I actually, down by the convention center early in the day, I was biking around, there was just cops everywhere, riot squad, dozens of riot squad coming out of the convention center. And so, so some windows got busted, the cops got, the riot squad got pushed back, and they were kind of aggressive, they peppered sprayed some people, it seems like, I didn't see it closely, and they got pushed back a couple blocks before the convention center, and then in this underpass area, it's kind of complicated to explain, but where the convention center is, people busted some windows, then the police then fired huge amount of tear gas. By this point, I had my actually daughter, a two-year-old, who with me in a stroller, and so when I saw that things were kind of heating up, I distanced myself from it, and I was like almost 2 blocks away from where the most of the protest was. And people were feeling the tear gas in the air. There were people, like just tourists coming out from old Montreal, were feeling tear gas. So yeah, so windows were broken. Almost for sure, the cops actually set the car on fire with tear gas. That's TVA and Montreal Gazette have both basically come up to that, basically stated that much. The police initially said it was protesters, though it was probably their tear gas that caused the fire. That's happened in the past year. And yeah, so some windows got busted. It's not really that, that's not that it's not that uncommon at CLAC demonstrations. Now, what happened was is that the Zionists, the international kind of like online social media sort of Zionist movement, which, has figures that are here in Canada, people in Israel, people in the U.S., all around, they basically just took this protest and said it was like the Hamas hordes have busted windows, and it was a day of, some of them called it Kristallnacht, Montreal's Kristallnacht, in reference to the the night of broken glass that launched the Nazis horrors. So they whipped up this whole thing, and they basically ignored that it was about NATO. It was actually a NATO summit. There was a big Palestine element to it. Like I said, it was the reason the demo was as big as it was because there was a student strike on Palestine, and that the the organizers of that kind of fed into the anti-NATO dimension. And so the sort of international kind of like network of Zionist influencers, if you call it that, on like Twitter, they just whipped this whole thing up, made a huge kerfuffle about it, and said it was huge anti-Semitic. Now, the Montreal police said they didn't see anything anti-Semitic, and they didn't receive any complaints of anti-Semitism. So a weird situation transpired the next day where the Montreal police had just repressed this demonstration, and they repressed it fairly significantly, like the tear gas, but also they put people in hospital. It's a guy who had his hand busted. And so the Montreal police, which had repressed this demonstration and has no love for CLAC, let me tell you, they basically then were defending the demonstration the next day from this like over-the-top claim of like, it was an anti-Semitic riot and this and that. And so, that kind of dimension played out, and you had Pierre Poilievre just completely lose it going after Trudeau, because Trudeau happened to be at the Taylor Swift concert in Toronto at more or less the same time, well, an hour or two after the protest. And they were basically saying Trudeau is dancing while Montreal is burning. I mean, it was literally like six windows that were broken. I went by the Palais de Congrès the next day, and it was just like, like six windows boarded up. I mean, it was not a particularly, riots after the Montreal Canadiens have won or lost have been far, far more substantive than this. Like I said, many CLAC demonstrations, May 1st demonstration this year, I think there was a handful of windows that were smashed. So this was just completely whipped out of proportion. Now, from a political standpoint, the sort of Zionist freakout is, this has become kind of the norm. They freak out about kind of everything, just rallies, normal rallies where there's just, people, 200 or 300 people marching very peacefully in the street. They try to whip into a big frenzy. From the standpoint of NATO, it got a lot of attention to the anti-NATO message. The next day, there was a demonstration planned by Mouvement Québécois pour la Paix against the NATO summit, and a whole bunch of media showed up. They took images of the No to NATO banners and signs that people were holding, got widespread international media coverage. So the Canada out of NATO message and the anti-NATO message got way, way more attention than it would have because of these windows being broken. So from the standpoint of the NATO, anti-NATO position, I think actually the window breaking was actually, I'm very ambivalent or against window smashing, but in this case, I actually think from the NATO perspective, it generated a lot of attention that wouldn't have been otherwise.
Beyond the 22nd, I didn't see much reporting about the counter-summit on the 24th, including speakers Midia Benjamin and Sevim Dagdelen from Germany. How many were in attendance physically and by Zoom, and what kind of presentations stood out for you?
Yeah, so that was actually the Sunday. So that had been organized like a couple months in advance. The Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network organized this counter summit for the Sunday, which was the 24th of November. And then the Mouvement Québécois had a demo organized for the 23rd, this Saturday. And then this Friday night demo was actually organized after those other two had begun being organized. And so the media actually showed up to the counter summit. Usually they would not have showed up. It was not a huge affair. I don't know the exact numbers. When I was there, there was probably 35, 40 people there. They went on for the whole day, so the people came in and out throughout the day. So it was an attempt to challenge this parliamentary summit. I think it was ultimately quite successful because it is part of what got the demonstration on Saturday and then the night demonstration on the Friday, what it got going. And like I said, you know, Radio-Canada, their téléjournal, the big their big news thing, they showed up at the counter summit and they did a pretty good 2.5 minute clip that really was sort of both sides. Here's the pro, here's the anti-NATO perspective. And we have to understand that, like, the dominant media gives, you know, NATO's this kind of weird issue where it's actually in the media a lot. There's a lot of NATO discussion, obviously, around Ukraine in the last couple of years. But then also there's a lot of NATO discussion around how Canada has to increase its military spending because of NATO. So you hear NATO mentioned in the media quite regularly, but basically no criticism of NATO. Like, this, basically almost no one saying, you know, we should withdraw from NATO, or NATO is a belligerent, militarist alliance. That's almost never heard. So the counter summit, and specifically the protests, basically did successfully get that message across. And the counter summit was a wide-ranging affair. There was, you know, presentation on I wasn't there for the whole day. I did a presentation on you know, Canada's role in NATO. The presentation before me was around Haiti and Canada's role in Haiti. So it was, you know, not just very narrowly defined, but it was a broader kind of discussion of Canadian imperialism, Canadian foreign policy, its connection to NATO, how NATO is a belligerent alliance. So yeah, a whole bunch of different topics were dealt with in the counter summit, and I think that the overarching storyline is that this was a very successful response to the NATO Parliamentary Assembly, because you have to, you know, understand that it's usually, I think, this parliamentary assembly would have happened with no formal response, no anti-war. You know, in recent years, there's been very little challenging of NATO, and so there was an actual response. And I think, in large part, because of the windows being busted, and because of this kind of weird scenario where this student strike for Palestine happened to coincide with the NATO summit, that all coming together led to you know, a much bigger demonstration on the Friday night than would have been otherwise, and obviously the windows being broken drew kind of media attention.
Sounds like it was a successful event, notwithstanding the smears in government and the press. Thanks a lot for sharing your insights on our show. Eve Engler is a noted activist and author. He joined us from Montreal. An event took place on Parliament Hill in Ottawa this past Tuesday. Over 100 Jews and allies occupied the Confederation Building on Parliament Hill this morning, calling for a full and immediate arms embargo against Israel. Led by the Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition, which includes IJV Toronto and York Region, protesters took over the building's entrance to demand that Canada stop arming Israel. I recently got hold of Rachel Small, a member of the group Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition, who took part in the action, to tell us more about what happened this week.
So on Tuesday morning, over 100 Jews and some beloved allies entered Confederation Building, which is a parliamentary building on Parliament Hill, and fully took over the whole lobby, main floor, entrance of that building. We were sitting shoulder to shoulder, all wearing matching shirts that said, Jews Say Stop Arming Israel. We were coming together in song. We had a rabbi with us who was leading us in Jewish prayer. And it was a very, very powerful moment. We filled and took over that space. There was absolutely not an inch for anyone to make it into the building. And this is a building that has over 130 members of parliament offices in it. And I mean, I think our message was very clear. Their business as usual in these marble hallways cannot continue while Canadian weapons are continuing to burn Palestinians alive in their tents. We're demanding that Canada immediately stop the flow of all weapons to and from Israel by implementing an arms embargo. We were there for over an hour, at which point the police kind of suddenly moved in and grabbed people from the back and started dragging them away and arresting them. Ultimately, about 14 people were arrested, and the rest of the group slowly left the building singing together, linked arms. We held a rally outside of the building for another couple hours until every single one of our friends was released to us on site, and we were all able to leave strong and united together. Ultimately, they were released with trespass notices.
You mentioned songs being sung. Can you tell us more about one of the songs and the impact it had on the overall action?
We sang a number of songs together that that do hold deep meaning. Some were Yiddish, which is a really important language to the Jewish diaspora all around the world, and some were in Hebrew. Some of them were songs that, at least for folks like me who grew up going to, you know, Jewish day school and in Jewish community and at our local synagogue congregation, like, we've been singing since we were toddlers. We sang a song, Lo Yisagoy. The words are Lo Yisagoy El Goy Cherev Lo Yilmedu Od Milchama, which is essentially about everyone has the right to live in peace and to live unafraid, and nations need to learn how to not carry out war anymore. We sang a song about kind of the tree of life, Eitz Chaim Hi, and is about kind of the sanctity of life. For me, a key Jewish learning from my childhood is that in every life is contained the whole world, and every life is precious, and we must never turn away from protecting life. It was really moving to be in that space together, refusing to be silent, refusing to be told that the actions of Israel and Canada's support of that were an effort to protect us as Jews, and instead saying, absolutely not. When we see this violence, when we see genocide, it is our job as Jews to stand up and to oppose it and to do that together. While singing these deeply powerful Jewish songs and sharing prayer was one of the more powerful moments in my life.
Did you have any members of parliament trying to talk with you?
Two members of parliament came right in and joined us, and they put on the shirts that say Canada Stop Arming Israel. That was Foreign Affairs critic MP Heather McPherson, as well as NDP MP Matthew Green. And both have been tireless advocates in parliament for an arms embargo, and it was really lovely and meaningful to have them there with us and in support. Leah Gazan, who is a Jewish member of parliament, who also has been just a really fierce advocate, joined us outside as well. I know that Mike Morris, an MP with the Green Party, spoke very shortly after inside the House of Commons and made sure that everyone there knew what had been happening on Parliament Hill just that morning, in case the MPs who don't have their office in that building had missed it. So it was nice to have that support from the members of Parliament. And I mean, in terms of the call for an arms embargo, 47 members of parliament have formally signed on and endorsed it and promised to do what they can to see that become a reality. So, I mean, really, we just need the Liberal government to follow through. It's already clearly the directive. And frankly, Melanie Joly has already said that Canadian arms must not be used to cause harm in Gaza. And while we appreciate that statement, we just need her to make that so.
I noticed the outspoken progressive Judy Rebick was speaking out about her allegiance to stopping future Holocausts directed not just against Jews, but against everyone, including Blacks, Roma, and Palestinians. With that angle, have you seen any indication that Jews in the wider landscape are getting the message, or are they just denouncing you as naive and wrong or something like that?
Mm-hmm. I was very moved by Judy's words inside the building. I mean, she expressed a lot of gratitude and love to be in this community together, all surrounded by people who are really putting themselves, their bodies on the line to defend the rights of Palestinian people, to stand up to violence. She said that she had never really imagined that she would be obliged to condemn genocide committed by Jews in her lifetime. And yeah, she did say never again means never again for everybody. And I think that, like any community, Jews across Canada are divided and have many different political opinions. But I do think that there's increasingly a looking to just the absolute horror of Israel's violence, of the bombing campaign they're carrying out, which is far and away the most devastating bombing campaign of the 21st century. And I think even if there's a division amongst Jewish communities across the country about whether an Israeli state should exist, or a two-state or a one-state or a whatever solution, I think that the tide is turning and an overwhelming number of Jews across Canada are saying, even if there are divisions, Israel has to stop slaughtering women, children, adults, people of all ages right now. That is completely unacceptable, and we cannot defend the actions of the state at all cost. Again, I'm speaking in generalizations, and there are as many opinions on what's happening as there are Jews in Canada. But when, for example, CIJA, the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, or B'nai B'rith, claims to speak on behalf of all Jews in Canada and claims that, you know, that the Jewish community stands behind Israel, I mean, that's clearly not true.
There was an announcement in the press yesterday that 19 Jewish groups spoke of your view as a minority fringe viewpoint, and that 90% of Jews were on side in favoring Israel. Does this statement diminish your hopes for success in any way?
No, I don't think so. I mean, first of all, maybe I'll point out that 90% statistic, I mean, all polls, you know, are a snapshot of a particular question asked at a particular moment in time to particular people. But I believe the question that was asked was like, should Israel exist? I really, to my understanding, the question was not, do you support Israel's actions? And there is no way they would get 90% of agreement on a question that's actually about support for what the Israeli military is carrying out right now. I will say that when I read that statement, I was thinking about a quote that I'm sure I will misquote right now, but something to the effect of, first they ignore you, then they belittle you or make fun of you, then they fight you, and then they win, and then you win. And again, I'm sorry if I've butchered that quote, but I do think that some of these larger Israel lobby groups are being forced to contend with us in a different way than they were a year ago. At first, we were being told by them, oh, there's no actual Jews at this action. It's a lie. They're pretending. Then it was, oh, they're self-hating Jews. They're not really part of the community. There was a lot of kind of making fun of us. Then now there seems to be, they seem to feel a need to launch sort of a concerted campaign against the efforts of our group. And to me, I mean, while I can never predict the future, to me, it's a sign that our growing power is being recognized and is a threat to the lobby that is trying to assert that Israel has a right to do whatever it wants.
With protests against the NATO summit in Montreal being denounced as violent, hateful, and anti-Semitic, did your group feel it was necessary to stage an action of your own to sabotage this claim that all protests against Israel stem from anti-Semitism?
I think that over the past 13 months, there have been many moments where, in some cases not real, and in some cases very real anti-Semitic actions have been used to try to paint any solidarity with Palestinians or any criticism of Israel's military violence as itself anti-Semitic. And it has felt very important as Jews to just condemn that in the strongest terms, to make it very clear that, I mean, frankly, no state represents a people, and Israel in no way represents us as Jews. And frankly, characterizing Israel's genocidal actions as connected to Jewishness is itself anti-Semitic. I mean, our actions are rooted in our Jewish values. And I mentioned in the Torah's command to not stand idly by while others suffer. And Jews Say No to Genocide as a coalition is deeply committed to justice, to the opposition of all forms of hatred, absolutely, including anti-Semitism, but also including Islamophobia, including any discrimination that targets any vulnerable communities. And so, yeah, we just firmly reject the notion that standing for human rights means turning against our own identity when, in fact, it's a testament to it. So it has felt very important, sure, in the context of the allegations in Montreal last week, but frankly, repeatedly over the past year, to make these assertions, to insist that we are not showing up to demand an end to Israel's violence despite being Jewish, but in fact because of it. And maybe for audiences in Winnipeg, if you don't mind me adding this on, I would say for folks listening in Winnipeg that Winnipeg plays actually a really important role in arming Israel. A really key component of Israel's most advanced fighter jet, the F-35, is manufactured right in Winnipeg at Magellan Aerospace. They make tail assemblies that are critical to this fighter jet. And I mean, there's many instances of Canadian complicity in Israel's military violence, but whatever folks who are currently being bombed by these warplanes in Gaza, in Lebanon, look up and see these F-35s, they're seeing jets that could not fly, that could not drop bombs on their heads without these components that are made at Canadian factories, including at Magellan, right in Winnipeg. So on one hand, what we're looking at is violence, horrific violence taking place on the other side of the world, but we're also looking at aspects of this violence that are happening right in our neighborhoods, right in our communities. And that's a space where we can all take action, be it through us taking a stand at the House of Commons and demanding the Canadian government do something differently, or be it through looking at tangibly, where are the weapons factories in our communities that are part of this this complicity and are part of arming a genocide right now? World Beyond War has put together a map at our website, worldbeyondwar.org/Canada Stop Arming Israel, that really lays out hundreds of locations across the country that are actively making parts for Israeli war machines. And I would urge folks to check it out, and also to check out armsembargonow.ca to get involved in the campaign to get Canada to implement an arms embargo. 47 members of parliament have already formally endorsed it. Maybe you can get your member of parliament to be next.
Well, Rachel Small, congratulations on your action, and thank you for joining me. Rachel Small is with World Beyond War, who is one of the members of the Jews Against Genocide Coalition and a participant in last Tuesday's action on Parliament Hill.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.
You're tuned in to 95.9 FM CKUW Radio from the University of Winnipeg.
Hello, this is David Barsamian, host and director of Alternative Radio. Established in 1986, award-winning Alternative Radio is dedicated to the founding principles of public broadcasting, which urge that programming serve as a forum for controversy and debate, be diverse, and provide a voice for groups that may otherwise be unheard. Tune in to Alternative Radio every Wednesday at 1 p.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM for an hour of some of the most important voices on the left today.